Kagan talked about the life and legacy of her friend and former colleague, Justice Antonin Scalia. Joining in the discussion, University of Notre Dame law professor William Kelly, a former law clerk to Justice Scalia, and Leonard Leo, executive vice president of the Federalist Society. This is About an Hour.
Sometimes people talk about members of their profession as lions of the profession, and I often have a difficult time understanding the analogy. Not so with Justice Scalia. He was, in his personal life, docile. And in public life, he had a roar that could be heard for miles. And so we thought it would be fitting today to bring together a few people who knew him very well to talk about his legacy, both personally and professionally. Next to me, of course, is Justice Kagan, who truly needs no introduction. You've had one last night. We were very fortunate to have her with us for the fireside chat. So I'll keep this brief, save to note that she's held pretty much, I think, every job in American law any young lawyer would aspire to have. And she did it as the first female dean of the Harvard Law School and the first female Solicitor General of the United States. In her first oral argument in Citizens United before Justice Scalia. We're going to hear that story this morning. Next to Justice Kagan is my friend Bill Kelly. He's now a professor at Notre Dame. He started his career as a law clerk to Justice Scalia. And in between those two things, he's done some mighty interesting things himself. He's served as an assistant to the Solicitor General of the United States, arguing before the Supreme Court, spent time in private practice, and was deputy counsel to the President of the United States in the Bush administration. He's a wonderful friend, and it's a real pleasure to have you here. He's also written one of the, I think, most insightful summaries of the justice's career. I commend it to you. It's in the George Washington Law Review, Justice Scalia and the Long Game. Next to Bill is Leonard Leo. Leonard is a close personal friend of the justice's and his family. So we get that perspective with us today. You may have seen him on C-SPAN reading from the scriptures at the justice's funeral. He's the executive vice president of the Federalist Society. He served on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. He's been a U.S. delegate to the U.N. Commission on Human Rights, among many, many other things. So you please join me in welcoming this wonderful panel this morning. Now, I plan to promptly get out of the way here, but to start things off, I think everybody who knew the justice probably has a favorite anecdote. The man was larger than life. Would each of you please share with us your favorite Scalia anecdote? Justice?
You know, I'm not sure I have a single anecdote. I have two ways that I'm going to remember him.
The first way is at conference at the court, and no particular conference, but just the experience of sitting with him at conference. So the way the conference table works in the Supreme Court, it's a long rectangular table, and the Chief Justice sits at one end, and the Senior Associate Justice sits at the other end, and then it goes around the table in order of seniority. And for all the time that I have been at the court, Justice Scalia was the Chief Associate Justice, so he sat on the opposite end of the table, and as the junior justice, I sat on his right, down at the other end from the Chief Justice. And Justice Scalia would keep up a kind of running patter throughout our conference. You know, in our conference, it's a pretty formal affair. Everybody talks in turn and so forth. But Justice Scalia would sort of sotto voce comment on everything. Comment on the cases, comment on everything that was being said about the cases. And anybody who knows Justice Scalia knows that he had really an extraordinary sense of humor. He was an extremely witty man. So So I would just be laughing all the time, except, you know, he was doing it kind of sotto voce so that nobody would notice him, and I would just sort of burst out laughing on occasion, and the Chief Justice would be looking down at the table like, what is going on there? And why is Justice Kagan interrupting the proceedings? And I always wanted to kind of, like, go like this, like, no, it's his fault, you know? But I, you know, when I remember him, that is the way I remember him most and best, is getting me into trouble at conference all the time because of his just incredible wit and maybe his irreverence as well. The second way I remember him is as, this is like as different can be, but is as a hunting partner. So there's a story behind this. You know, I grew up in New York City. We did not do a lot of hunting. But as I went through the nomination process, people asked me a lot of questions about whether I had, you know, any connection with hunting or guns or gun culture or whatnot. And I failed all of these questions miserably because the answer was no, I've basically been an urban East Coaster all my life. This is something that's pretty foreign to my set of experiences. I was once talking to a senator and he was asking me all these questions, but I said, you know, it's true that I've not had these experiences, but I said I'd like to have them, and if you would invite me to your ranch to go out hunting with you, I'd love to come. And this senator, like, this abject look of horror came over his face. And the White House staffer who accompanied me on all these visits was, like, had fallen off the sofa. And I thought, okay, I went too far, so I tried to pull it back a little bit, and I said, well, I didn't really mean to invite myself hunting with you, but I will tell you what, if I'm lucky enough to be confirmed, I promise you that the first thing I'll do is that I'll go to Justice Scalia and ask him to take me hunting. And so when I did get confirmed, one of the first things that I did was I went to Nino and I told him this story. And he thought it was hilarious. I mean, he was just, he thought it was the funniest thing. And so he took me to his gun club and he taught me how to shoot. And taught me about gun safety. And at a certain point, he said, okay, I think you're ready to go. And he invited me out with a very long-standing group of hunting buddies he had. We went out to near Charlottesville, Virginia, the first time, and we shot quail. And what surprised me, and I think is just a measure of his incredible personal generosity, was that he didn't do this as just like a one-time thing. It's a funny story, and I'll let Kagan satisfy this campaign promise of hers. But he just kept on asking me, and he basically said, join our group and be a part of this thing that he loved so much. And one of the reasons I'll remember it in him always in that context is because, you know, one of the things that I think made Justice Scalia Justice Scalia was this incredible joy of life. And I've really never seen anybody enjoy something more than he did hunting. And it was sort of wonderful to watch this man just have this incredible joie de vivre as he did this thing. And also, I mean, it was on those trips where I really got to know Nino extremely well. I mean, we came out to Wyoming for a few days once, we went down to Mississippi for a few days, and then on these day trips, you know, it's 2 hours in the car to Charlottesville or to Richmond, 2 hours back. There's a lot of time to talk. And so a lot of my personal connection with Nino came from those trips, and that's the way that that I find myself remembering him sort of over and over again.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Judge Gorsuch, and it's great to see so many friends. As I was thinking about this, it occurred to me, you know, it's not every day that one sits on a panel next to a Supreme Court justice. Justice Scalia would have said a supreme justice. I'm sure Justice Kagan has heard that. And so that's a little intimidating, but I have to say it's not nearly as intimidating as it was over 30 years ago to be a rising second-year student on the Harvard Law Review facing the supervising editor, Elena Kagan. She was truly scary then. And I think she'd agree, too. And then the first thing she does is tell an anecdote about the stinking conference where no human being is allowed to go unless they have a commission to the Supreme Court. How are you supposed to follow that? Well, I can't follow that, but I will say that as I think about anecdotes in the justice, the idea of Joie de Vivre first comes to mind. The laugh. He would laugh a lot. And he would say things which he believed to be obviously true and wait for one to react. And if you disagreed, he'd express false outrage. And if you agreed, he'd laugh. The one anecdote that comes to mind sitting here was when I was with him, my wife and I were expecting our first child. This is a long time ago, 28 years, his third term. And I knew that the boss had 9 children. So I was looking for tips. Justice, any parenting tips? No, come on. Tips? What do you mean? Besides, Maureen did everything. But I'll tell you this. If she's a pain in the neck when she's young, she's going to be a pain in the neck her whole life. And if she's not, she's not. So you got a lot at stake at the beginning, let me tell you. I can say happily that it turned out well, both at the beginning and at the end.
Well, I guess there are two things that come to mind. One is a story that the justice used to regale us with lots of times, and we never told him. We had heard it several times already. And it had to do with his senior year at Georgetown. And of course, he was a great student there. And there was a tradition back then that you had to have an oral exam before a board of priests at Georgetown. I don't think they do that now. But he had his oral exam, and as he describes it, he was just hitting them out of the park, one question after the next. You know, he knew his Renaissance literature, he knew his history, he had been grounded in the ancient history, so he thought he was just doing great. And then the chairman of the murder board, a priest, said, "Well, we just have one final question for you, Mr. Scalia. What was the most important event in human history?" And he doesn't remember the answer he gave, but what he remembers is all sorts of events in human history rushing through his mind. You know, the Peloponnesian Wars, some incidents from the Roman Empire, the invention of the printing press. And he rattled off one of these events in human history, and the priest just shook his head and said, "No, Mr. Scalia, the incarnation of Christ." And he describes himself as just shrinking, you know, just to a tiny little person in front of this committee. And what was wonderful about the story, for all of us who always heard it, was first, as I think Bill alluded to, he loved to joke about himself. He had a great self-effacing sense of humor. And so he was telling a story about a failure of his, which I think said a lot about the person. It was the way he opened up to a lot of people. But secondly, I think it said a lot about both his humility and about how he views human life. You know, he was looking, the way he puts it, he was looking for some great event in human history, something that man did that made civilization great. And what, you know, the answer that was the one he was supposed to give had nothing to do with human greatness, right? And I think that says a lot about who he is and how he conducted his life. So,
do you have an anecdote?
I get to ask the questions.
Okay, sorry. I just thought, you know. Okay.
I love fly fishing with the justice, as you know. I would say he fished exactly as you'd expect someone from Queens, New York to fish.
There are no fish in this river. That was the one time he would take judicial notice on fishing trips.
Growing up in Colorado, you learn how to place a fly on the water with some gentleness. There was no gentleness. But what there lacked in finesse, he made up for in enthusiasm. He absolutely loved it. Justice, you've spoken about his contributions to statutory interpretation. And I wonder if you'd share some of your thoughts with us about textualism and his views on that.
I was very honored last year to give the Antonin Scalia lecture at Harvard Law School. A donor wanted to honor him and thought that the way to do so was to establish this lecture series, and I was asked to do it and thought it was really a terrific honor. And this was when he was alive, and I went and I spoke with my friend and one of his clerks, John Manet, about his contributions to statutory interpretation. And I think what I said there was that he should have declared victory long ago. That this is, I think, what Justice Scalia will go down in history for, more than anything else, is having changed the entire enterprise of statutory interpretation. So I'll do this, if you'll indulge me a little bit, with a story about a particular case of mine, which I had in my first year at the court. It's a case called Milner, and it was a Freedom of Information Act case, and it dealt with the scope of an exemption for the Freedom of Information Act, meaning that the scope of something where the government could hold back rather than disclose materials. And it was an exemption for, I think it was called, internal personnel procedures and practices. And somehow the D.C. Circuit had created out of this idea of you can withhold materials relating to internal personnel practices this exemption that said you can withhold anything that would allow people to violate the law. And the way they did it was, there were a set of D.C. Circuit opinions about this exemption written by really superb judges at a time this is the time when Bill and I both went to law school in the 1980s. And, they didn't really mention the text of the exemption until, page 18 of the opinion. And they just talked about all kinds of things that they found in the legislative record, and they talked about how it just made sense for this exemption to exist. And so that was the question, was whether this exemption was still as interpreted by the D.C. Circuit in a way that had been going on for decades by the time of this case had gotten to the court. And I remember going to conference one morning, and I met Nino on the way in. Actually, not on the way in. The way the Supreme Court offices are set up, he was sort of down the hall from me. And it was really quite something. He would come out of his office door, and he would look down the hall to see if anybody was coming. The two other people down the hall were Justice Thomas and me. And then he would kind of wait for you to come up the hall. And I always felt like a teenage girl being, somebody was waiting for me to walk to school together or something like that. It was just sort of anyway. So he waited for me to come down the hall and we walked the rest of the way to the conference room. And I said, I've just been reading these cases. And I mean, everything about the way we do statutory interpretation is different. You cannot imagine anybody writing these kinds of decisions now. I mean, nobody on the court, on the left, on the right, and, nobody on the court would think you could write a decision which didn't really even mention the statutory text. Nobody on the court would write a decision which placed front and center random materials from the legislative record and legislative history. Nobody on the court would just think it was enough to say, well, this kind of makes sense as we see it. And that had all changed in the prior couple of decades, and really it had all changed because of Justice Scalia. And I always felt as though, Justice Scalia was still, the rest of us were not quite purist enough for Justice Scalia. Sometimes we would mention legislative history, sometimes we would say something that he would have thought was not completely in keeping with the focus on the text. But I always thought that he had won 80% of the game, and that the only reason that everybody didn't recognize that the entire court had moved extremely far in his direction was because he kept on demanding that we go the last 20%. But in fact, if he had been a little bit more of a diplomat or a little bit less of a fighter, what he would have said was, isn't this cool? Basically, everybody interprets statutes the way that I've been saying they should. And I think that that's right.
Gents, you want to add to that?
Well, I think what Justice Kagan just said is exactly right, and it's part was part of his personality that he believed that human beings were imperfect, and so the last bit would have been difficult for him to take.
It rankled.
It rankled. That's the right word. It rankled. But he did, almost single-handedly transform the terms of not only how things are done, but the debate about how things are done. It's even those who don't agree with Justice Scalia's statutory interpretation theories have to deal with them. And that really is quite a change over the last generation.
The only other thing I'll add, I guess, on this is I would commend to everyone his last book, Reading Law, which I think could potentially go down as being as important as Blackstone's commentaries or Cook's Institutes, at least for Americans. I mean, here is, I think, a great exposition of how much he cared about language and about construction. Taking on the whole thrust and parry of the canons of construction and trying to explain that there is determinate meaning to the enterprise of interpretation, even with regard to these canons that are often thrown about rather loosely. So he had an incredible, extraordinary breadth of knowledge in this area of construction, and I think that final work is a very important capstone to his career.
It's a terrific book, Neil, you and I talked yesterday about the Lockhart decision, which
yes.
was a decision last year where the court had to wrestle with very, weird statutory language, and Justice Sotomayor wrote the majority and I wrote the dissent, and we really went at each other, but what one of the notable things about that decision was that both opinions relied on Justice Scalia's book. Now, that's not to say that Justice Scalia's book, it's like you can make anything of it. It's, sometimes there are good arguments on both sides, and there were arguments on both sides that could be found in the many, many pages of that book. I think what it's a sign of, and I think that this is going, you're going to see this over the next decade, is that's going to be kind of the standard reference when it comes to statutory interpretation questions, in particularly about the statutory canons.
Now, the publisher has just said, okay, Justice Kagan, quote, the standard reference, close quote. It's going to be on every paperback.
It's fewer than 140 characters. Justice, we have to hear the story about Citizens United. Your very first appellate oral argument, I just cannot imagine that being my first. I need to hear that story.
Well, I was very nervous. It was my first appellate argument. I was nominated to the SG position for whatever reason because I had not done an appellate argument. And to have your first one be at the Supreme Court, to have your first one be of the importance of Citizens United, I was pretty nervous. And making me even more nervous, the day before I had gone up to the court, because the day before the argument was the investiture of Justice Sotomayor. And I think the clerk of the court, General Souter, he was just, looking to be nice, making conversation. And he said, oh, I'll show you what will be on the bench for the justices when you go up to the podium. This is what the justices look at. And what the justices look at, it's just a few pages with your standard biographical material and who's made the motion for you to be a member of the Supreme Court bar and things like that. But then attached to it is a list of the Supreme Court arguments you have done in the past. And he hands me this pile of papers, and there were three other lawyers who were arguing that day, and the pile of papers, the first one is Ted Olson, and it's, the list sort of goes on, and you're flipping pages, and he's done 90 arguments, and the second one was Seth Waxman, and he's done 75 arguments, and you're still flipping pages. And the third one was Floyd Abrams, and he was like a relative newbie to the court. He had only done 25 arguments. And then it said Elena Kagan, and there was no paper, So I said to General Souter, I said, are you trying to psych me out? Is that what you're doing? Anyway, but I get up there the next day, and my heart really is pounding. And, you know, I almost, like, couldn't hear anybody for it pounding so hard. But I finally, I get up to the podium. I think I was third, fourth. I had a few sentences, five or six sentences memorized to get me into the argument, and I thought I would get five or six sentences out before the justices interrupted me. And I got a single sentence out, literally one sentence, and it was a short sentence, too. And then from the bench I hear, no, 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 no. And then he proceeded to tell me why this single declarative sentence I had uttered was 100% wrong. But it was great for me that day, best thing that could have happened to me, because it's just like when that comes at you, you have to deal with it, and you have to say something back. And as soon, and I said something back, and I thought, okay, I'm in this game. So it was like a great favor that he did to me, I think. And for the entire year, I actually loved being questioned by Justice Scalia. And as Solicitor General, you know, I argued a very wide range of cases, and some were cases in which Justice Scalia naturally, agreed, predictably agreed, and some were cases in which the position I took, Justice Scalia did not agree. But either way, I actually loved being questioned by Justice Scalia. He asked questions in a very straightforward way. They were often extremely tough. They were often extremely aggressive, but there was never anything hidden in them. There was no sort of, like, hidden agenda, and there was no lack of clarity. You always knew exactly where he was coming from and exactly what he meant. And he also gave you a chance to respond to those questions, which sometimes in Supreme Court argument you don't have. But he was very fair in that way, you know. He was going to give you the best he had, but he was going to give you a chance to argue back. So for the entire year, I so enjoyed the back and forth with Justice Scalia, found it if I picked a single justice where I just case in, case out, whether I was with him or against him, or whether he was with me or against me, just case in, case out, that those were the exchanges that I enjoyed best. It was with him.
Bill, as a law clerk, give us some insight to his workings, and he could be tough on counsel at oral argument, and maybe some insight into why.
Well, I was there his third term. So he was a young person and still learning the job. And one of the things about becoming a federal judge, as many in the room know, and a Supreme Court justice in particular, is that there's a lot of law to learn. And we expect our federal judges to become expert in every area of substantive federal law and procedural federal law. It's a hard thing to do. And when you're on the Supreme Court, you're expected to write opinions that will meet this stern criticism of the smartest people specializing in patent law, antitrust law, labor law, federal courts, criminal procedure, the whole gamut. You're supposed to be expert at the level of the true experts in every subject. It's a really hard thing to do. So there's a lot to learn. It's very hard. It's a very hard job. So it was new and exciting to him, and it was incredibly exciting and fun to be with him as he was figuring out what he thought, because he genuinely didn't have views about most questions when he began on the Supreme Court. He knew a lot about administrative law and the regulatory questions that came before him on the D.C. Circuit, but he was not a world expert on criminal procedure or things like that. And so he was learning, and he loved it, and it was fun, but it was hard. His process was that after he had read the briefs and you had read the briefs, he would gather all of the law clerks for a meeting before the conference in every case. And the group would talk about every case for as long as it took for him to get to a point where he thought knew what he thought. And that experience, to this day, was as extraordinary a legal experience as I've had and as challenging of one as I've had, because just as he was a very active questioner on the bench, imagine what it was like when there was nobody listening. And it was fun and very, very challenging. And for us as well, the excitement was that this, we really felt like Justice Scalia was different. He was new and different because he really cared about theory and methodology and the right way to do the job appropriate to the role of judges in our constitutional system. He really cared about that from the beginning. And to see him work out that was really quite extraordinary. And part of the reason why I think he was so aggressive in argument, at least frequently so, and sometimes in his opinions he was very aggressive, as we all know, particularly his separate opinions, was that for him it wasn't personal. It just wasn't. It was about the law. He took seriously that he was, when he put the robe on, it was the office and not the person. And he understood that and believed it and lived it in a way that from case to case across 30 years that really was extraordinary. He did not care who won the case. He didn't care. If it was the government in a criminal case, the government's got to follow the law. What is the law? That's what he cared about. What's the right legal answer? And it wasn't that he didn't care about the human consequences of cases. He thought that the people of the United States had established the ways in which the legal system would resolve these questions about people's legal rights and duties. And no one had given him the power to decide who should win, except insofar as the law dictated that answer. And so for him, it was the law. It wasn't the person that mattered in case after case, term after term. That's who he was. He would have no more thought that it was his role to decide winners and losers in a legal case in terms of the consequences of the outcome than he would have thought it was his role to go across the street to the Congress and urge them to pass or not pass a law which will have consequences for people. That wasn't his job, he thought. And so that was reflected in how he dealt with the ideas and the legal materials. The legal materials, man, that's what he cared about.
Leonard, tell us a little bit about the justice's personal life that we don't know. He was a big family man. He started his career, I don't think many people know, in Ohio.
Yeah, so he started his career as a practicing lawyer, I believe it was Jones Day, in Ohio. Looking back on this career, not necessarily what you would expect, right? He was occasionally asked about that by law students, and he gave a very interesting answer. We had talked about it at one point. He said that, you know, when he got out of law school and he entered into the practice of law, you know, of course he loved the law, and he was very good at it, but he thought it was very important to be a good father and husband, and he wanted a reasonable legal career. One where he could spend time with his family, and one that was not going to be as frenetic. And back then, he says, Jones Day was a firm that recognized the importance of balancing work and family. And you see that throughout his career. Even though he was extraordinarily busy, obviously with being a lawyer and then being an academic and then being a judge and also being a government official, he always had time for his family. They are a very closely knit family. They had great fun together, particularly at the dinner table, where there was lots of banter, as you can imagine, much like around a conference table in a court. Always great jokes. So he had a great family life, and you'd always see a twinkle in his eye when he'd talk about his children and his many grandchildren. I think it was, I keep forget the number now, but it's quite a number. Is it 42? It's a very large number of grandchildren. So he was a great family man. He was also, of course, very devoted to his faith. And there's one image that's just indelibly marked in my mind about that. He'd sit, he'd after Holy Communion, he'd go back toward the back of the church, go back to the pew, kneel, bow down, completely still and silent for a long time, with his face cupped in his hands. And that was, for me, just a tremendous symbol of his humility. And I think that it spoke volumes about who he was. And that was, of course, very much instilled upon his family, though they tell different stories about the frenetic rush to get to Mass. You can imagine when you have 9 children, it's not easy to get out of the house for 9 a.m. Mass on a Sunday, or you know, getting into Mass late and, you know, sort of ruffling around. But ultimately, he imparted a tremendous sense of faith and family on his children. And you can see it in them. They're all great. I mean, they're all great kids. Many of you probably saw Father Paul Scalia's celebration of the funeral Mass in Washington. And, of course, you were there. And it was extraordinary, right, to see his son preside over that Mass for, what, 2 hours? Must have been at least 2 hours. Have to cross the casket to stand before his entire family to deliver what was probably one of the most powerful homilies I've ever seen at a funeral Mass or any Mass. And that is, I think, a tremendous tribute to his dad, right? That was in many ways a manifestation of that upbringing. So it's really quite powerful.
Justice, can you share with us what the holiday parties at the court were like with Justice Scalia?
The Supreme Court has a Christmas party every year, and Justice Scalia was the, I don't know if he was the self-appointed, I suspect he was the self-appointed sort of head of singing. He had a great voice, so he would sort of lead. There's a room that in the Supreme Court where the caroling took place, and he would lead the caroling with a great deal of gusto. But in terms of his singing and his music and the joy he brought to that as well, the thing I remember actually even more than the holiday party is we have this tradition at the court. The court is a place of many traditions, some of them a little bit peculiar. One of them is we gather for any justice's birthday, all 9 of us, and we sing happy birthday to whoever's birthday it is. And Justice Scalia was the only one of us who could sing. So Justice Scalia would sing happy birthday, and the rest of us would go kind of, you know. And then after Justice Scalia's passing, we had to kind of carry on without Justice Scalia's voice, and it really sounded atrocious. It was terrible. So all of us were like, oh my gosh, bring Nino back, please.
Bill, we've talked a little bit about the justice's statutory interpretation contributions. We haven't yet touched on his contributions to the interpretation of the Constitution and his originalism. Some people profess surprise when the justice often ruled in favor of criminal defendants, whether it be in the Sixth Amendment context, Crawford, Fourth Amendment, Kelo, Jones, the rule of lenity, which he promoted, or vagueness doctrine, even just last term in the ACCA cases. Do you see those rulings as surprises?
No, I don't think in general it was surprising at all that his interpretive methodology would lead him with some frequency to rule in favor of criminal defendants. When people sometimes criticize him and other judges and justices for being results-oriented, I often think, you think as a policy matter they think it's a good thing if a person who's obviously guilty of a serious crime goes free? As a policy matter, that's a good outcome? That you would want that? Of course not. But there are more important values at stake than the immediate than that immediate question, obviously. And so for the justice, he took some time intellectually to come to the view that originalism was the right way to interpret the Constitution with all of its challenges and foibles. And one thing he liked to say is, you can't beat something with nothing, and there's not a lot of good competitors out there. That's what he would say. And so, if he believed that the Constitution, as originally understood, its original meaning, required an outcome, then of course that's where he would go, without fear or favor, every time. One thing about Justice Scalia's personality was that he believed, or his views, he believed that the default position of human beings in this country is one of freedom. That's where we start. We're free, and something's got to intervene to change that in the law. And the Constitution, originally meant, ruled some abridgments on people's liberty out of bounds. It's that simple. That's obviously very simple for lawyers to hear that talk. But the fundamental fact was, for him, to the extent that he was libertarian when it came to criminal procedure cases, it was because he believed that the Constitution itself was founded upon libertarian premises. When people are dealing with the government in situations where the criminal law is at stake, the people who made this law made sure that the freedoms of people could not be abridged in specific ways, and he followed that where he thought it led.
Would either of you two like to comment on originalism in the justice letter?
Well, I think it was part of a broader enterprise for him, which is the preservation and defense of the structural Constitution. I think one of the most important contributions he made was inspiring two generations of law students to think about the Constitution in a different and really important way. If you go back to the 70s and 80s, and even to some extent today, when you ask people about the Constitution or about constitutionalism, they tend to talk about rights, you know, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, criminal procedure rights, privacy, equal protection. And I remember he used to say over and over again, as he crisscrossed the country talking to law students, he used to say, he used to ask, why is America such a free country? If you think it's the Bill of Rights, you're crazy. Every president for life, every banana republic, even the former evil empire, the former Soviet Union, had a bigger and better Bill of Rights than ours. And the point he was trying to make was that without the structural Constitution, without separation of powers, federalism, checks and balances, bicameralism, to talk about all of these different structural features with law students all the time. Without those things, those rights are just parchment guarantees. And I think, of course, the limited role of the judiciary, which is tied up with the issue of originalism and how one goes about the business of interpreting laws in the Constitution, is a part of this commitment to defending the structural Constitution as, in his view, I think, the most important bulwark of freedom and the dignity and worth of the human person in our constitutional system.
I was reminded when Bill said that in his view originalism didn't have to be perfect, it just had to be better than the other methodological contenders. I was reminded of a joke that Justice Scalia used to tell about this, and it was about two guys in a forest, and a bear comes along, and one of the guys starts running, and the other says, why are you running? You can't outrun a bear. And the guy who's running says, I don't have to outrun a bear, I just have to outrun you. And that is true with respect to constitutional methodologies. Nothing's perfect, and the question is, you know, what's better than the rest? Now, you know, I myself, it's going to be no shock to you all, think that originalism is not better than the rest, and I'm not going to take time now to talk about that, but instead just to say one thing about Justice Scalia's contribution in this area, which is that I think Justice Scalia put on the table for absolutely everybody, those who reached his answer and those who didn't reach his answer, a pretty fundamental question and a pretty fundamental challenge, and that was that somehow, everybody had to come up with a method of resolving constitutional problems that disciplined judges. In other words, that a judge couldn't do whatever he or she wanted, that a judge couldn't say, here are my values, here are my principles, here are my politics, here's the way I think a perfect world would look like, that was not the way to do law, and it was not the way to do constitutional law any more than it was the way to do other law. And that what Justice Scalia, I think, but what his outspoken, even aggressive formulation of originalist principles and an originalist methodology, what it did was to make everybody else, those who didn't share his answer as well as those who did, grapple with this question of, if it's not that, if it's not the originalist answer, if it's not that, what does discipline judges? And you have to come up with an answer to that question, and if you don't have one, indeed originalism does win. The only way it loses, and the only way another method of interpreting the Constitution can be better than it, is if it has a better is if it, among its other virtues, has an answer to the question of how are judges disciplined, so that it's just, so that it's not all about them, it is about the law.
Justice, I don't know if you saw this when you were at law school teaching, but I also get the impression that he improved upon the originalist enterprise in some important ways. When I went to law school in the 80s, we talked about it more as original intent, and law students had a tendency of trying to get into the heads of particular framers, and I think his originalism was much more, if not exclusively, about public meaning and a proper use of originalist materials that way. And so I think in addition to advancing the theory of originalism and its relationship to the disciplining of judges, I think he actually improved upon its approach in a way that I think is very important for people across the ideological and philosophical spectrum, because there are people like Akhil Amar and others on the left who tend to use originalist principles a little more than maybe 20 years ago. And I think that's partly because it's been, tweaked a bit in good part by Justice Scalia's work.
I just want to add a word about this subject, two separate very quick points. One is, I do think that the in these times in which we live, in the legal world and more broadly, it is important to just note and reflect upon the reality that the nine justices who disagree about big things very sharply sing happy birthday to one another, that Justice Kagan is here speaking about her friend Justice Scalia, even though they disagreed mightily about big, big questions. And the Supreme Court and how it functions collegially should be a role model for all of us in our professional and personal lives. That's point one. Point two is, I also want to just say a word about precedent. The justice did believe in precedent. He believed in the rule of stare decisis. He would sometimes, in his office and in talking about cases, he would point to the commission on the wall and he'd say, "I am not a nut." And you have to, he's responsible for, he said, I'm the one responsible for the vote, and for what I say, and stare decisis is part of our system. And so one way in which we temper deep and fundamental philosophical disagreements about how judges should go about their jobs and how judges should interpret the law is through the doctrine of precedent. The reason why, frequently at least, that Justice Kagan and Justice Scalia could agree in a case about something that matters a lot in the real world would be that they would agree that the precedents lead to an outcome. And I think that's an important safety valve in the system of jurisprudence that we have.
All three of you are among the finest legal educators in the country. And I know Justice Scalia cared passionately about legal education. And one of his great memorials, Leonard is involved in, with the renaming of the George Mason University Law School in the justice's honor. I wonder whether you all might comment on his views and contribution to legal education. Leonard, do you want to start with this?
Well, he always loved being a teacher.
And I think even when he was a judge, he was really a teacher. He used to talk about how his dissents were a way of imparting ideas on future generations of law students and lawyers. I think it's very fitting that there be a law school named in his honor because of his dedication to teaching the law. George Mason, obviously, is a school that, you know, is near where he lived and worked. And he also gave the dedication speech to George Mason many, many years earlier when it first started. So it's, in that respect, a very appropriate place. But he had a tremendous love for the Legal Academy broadly. I think he had great affection for what was going on at Harvard, particularly under Justice Kagan's leadership back then. He used to talk about that from time to time. He loved his years teaching at UVA and Chicago and even Stanford briefly. And he loved crisscrossing the country talking to law students. He used to spend an hour and a half on his feet fielding question after question after question. And he did occasionally get a question about legal education. Occasionally a law student would get up and say, "What should I do here at law school to really prepare well?" And this goes back to, I think, a point that Bill, I think you made about how people expect federal judges to be experts at everything. He used to tell law students, take the real law clauses, law courses, take intellectual property, take tax, take the statutory courses. Learn how to be a real lawyer and learn real law. Sure, you can take a seminar on law and philosophy, but take those other real law courses because that's what you're going to need. And he used to express regret sometimes at not taking enough of those in law school.
I'll just add that he would often say, I'm sure many of us in the room have heard him say, that the reason why he wrote his separate opinions was for the law students and for the future generations of lawyers. Given the rest of his personality, he was surprisingly optimistic in the sense that he actually thought that reason would and should prevail. And so he would make the case, and he would say, "Yeah, I didn't persuade people this time, but maybe next time." And sometimes that happened. But he also wanted to make his separate opinions, especially his dissenting opinions, more fun to read. And because law students have short attention spans, I guess, and so. Part of that was his educational mindset was, I want to, if I can't persuade people today, I'm thinking about 10 years from now.
And he succeeded in that. I mean, I was a classroom teacher for 15 years, and I taught thousands of students. And the most fun classes almost always involved a Justice Scalia opinion. And students are mesmerized by the way Justice Scalia writes. And sometimes you wanted to shake them a little bit. It's like, no, but come on, just look past the way he writes, you know? The way he writes is mesmerizing. And positions that you didn't think you would ever be attracted to all of a sudden become attractive because of the way he presents them and argues them. And if he did say a number of times that his target audience was law students, and boy, he hit the bullseye because law students, they come in, they open up these textbooks, it's dry opinion after dry opinion. Nobody looks as though they have a sense of humor. Nobody looks as though there's no life. And then you reach a Justice Scalia opinion, and you start smiling, and you start nodding along, and you start fighting with him within the opinion. And I mean, it's just the opinions it's a hard thing even to describe. But year after year after year, class after class after class, all these students, they would come to me and they would say, I came to law school like a good liberal, and I just find myself really attracted to what he's saying. Now, he would say that was because of the power of his ideas, and I'll let him have that. But in addition to that, There's just an incredible power behind the style. And he knew what was going to make law students sit up and take notice, and they did.
Where will we rank Justice Scalia in the pantheon of justices 100 years from now?
I'm not sure I want to do a ranking, but one of the things that I said up at Harvard, and I'm glad, you know, he was alive then, and I'm glad he knew that I had said this. He actually critiqued my entire Scalia lecture. It was fantastic. John Manning sent him a tape. He watched the whole tape. He came back and he had like 4 points of agreement and 4 points of disagreement. It was tremendous. He said, "You really listened to that thing? You took an hour of your life to..." And, you know, it was like, well, of course I did. You know, what are you talking about? It's tremendous. But one of the things I said then was I said, you know, all of us, 100 years from now, most of us, our names are going to be forgotten. Nobody's going to know who we are. We seem important now, but in the long course of history, I assure you, if you go back to justices in 1916, you won't know a lot of those names. I think that's true for the current court and more modern justices as well. Not true of Justice Scalia. I do think that Justice Scalia is going to rank up there as one of the greats, as one of the most important figures on the court, because of the methodological positions that we've talked about up here, because of the way he wrote, because of the way he changed the way we all talk about law. I think that that's maybe the most fundamental thing, and it was a little bit implicit in the answer I gave to your statutory interpretation question, but agree with him, disagree with him. I mean, Justice Scalia changed the framing of legal arguments. He changed the way we all speak and argue about law. Pretty big accomplishment. So 100 years from now, people are going to wake up, and they're going to say, who were the great Supreme Court justices? Who were the important Supreme Court justices? Regardless of whether you agree or disagree with any number of decisions, he's going to be high on that list.
I completely agree. I did write one time that when Justice Scalia was appointed, there was lots of comment, nominated actually, not appointed, nominated, there was a lot of commentary that this very young and charismatic and charming and full of life person would be very effective on the Supreme Court, walking the halls and charming his colleagues into agreeing with him in contested cases. And that was part of the narrative, actually, before he was confirmed. And then very quickly, several years later, the narrative is he's too pugnacious and he alienates people and he's ineffective. It's my view that the justice, again, did play the long game, and he wanted the ideas and the words to matter over time. And I think what Justice Kagan says about transforming the terms of debate in a fundamental way is exactly right. And I think he will be remembered for that. He will be remembered as well, I think also, and it's not unrelated, for his prose. I mean, the prose really was unbelievable. I mean, it's no insight to say that after Justice Jackson, or with Justice Jackson, it's harder to find better prose in Supreme Court opinions than that of Justice Scalia. And I do think that that is sometimes distracting from the underlying substance. I think what Justice Kagan said about students being beguiled by the verve of the writing without really digging into the underlying substance can sometimes be true. I think some of Justice Jackson's opinions are better written than reasoned. But having said that, one thing Justice Scalia would frequently say is that good and clear writing is a sign of good and clear thinking. And the opposite is true as well. And I think that history will treat him kindly on both fronts.
I have no doubt that he'll be remembered as a great justice. I also hope that he'll be remembered as a great American, which not only has to do with the quality of your work product, but with your integrity, your honesty, your dedication to our country and its ideals, your dedication to faith and to family. And so my hope is that he will be both a great justice to many people, but also remembered as a great American who defended our country's principles and stood up for what good character ought to be in public life more broadly.
Will you join me in thanking our panel?
Great to be with you.
Great to see you.
You too. Safe travels. I'll see you soon. I'll probably see you a couple times this fall as I come back to these events.